This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Ik. It's a Friday afternoon, so it's our Doctor in House segment with my co-host, consultant urologist, Dr. George Lee. It's also a very special segment today. We also have a minister in the house, well, joining us over via Zoom, rather, YB Khairi Jamaluddin, Minister of Science, Technology and Innovation, and also Coordinating Minister for the National COVID-19 Immunization Program. Welcome to the both of you. How are you today?
Good, thank you.
Well, I'm very excited. Certainly, all the listeners out there in Klang Valley will be very excited today with the YB himself on the spot.
Well, yes. And what we want to discuss today is COVID-19 variants, especially in Malaysia. And what does it mean for our vaccination program? So the Ministry of Health has reported several local COVID-19 cases involving the B1351 variant, which is a more contagious variant that was first detected in South Africa. Not only that, some vaccines are also said to be less effective against this variant as well. So what we would like to find out from YB today is how we are keeping track of different variants and how, more importantly, will this affect ongoing COVID-19 vaccinations. If you have any questions for us, our lines are open, 0377 332 900, WhatsApp 0187 89 8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, YB, you just got your second dose of the Sinovac vaccine yesterday. How are you feeling?
I feel great. There was no significant side effects, slight soreness at the point of injection. But other than that, I didn't feel anything.
All right. Did you recover your ability to speak Mandarin, hopefully?
Oh, it's even more fluid now.
Fantastic. And George, you also got your second dose this week itself, didn't you?
Indeed. Well, I got the other one. I got the Pfizer vaccine. So, can't say that my Mandarin becomes more fluent, but I guess at the end of the show, I'll probably speak with American accent now.
Or some German. So both of you, real poster boys for the vaccination, program, what we want to push for. But first, YB, perhaps we could get some updates. There's so many bits of developments happening around the vaccination. So AstraZeneca has been getting a lot of attention recently. And just this week, the European Medicines Agency has included the development of rare blood clots as a possible side effect of the vaccine. Now, you've said that the Special Committee on COVID-19 Vaccine Supply Access Guarantee will be deliberating on the use of AstraZeneca in Malaysia. Do you have any updates for us?
Okay. Yes. So, the European Medicines Agency has issued a statement saying that there is a causal link between the AstraZeneca vaccine and some rare cases of blood clots. This is the first time there has been an acknowledgement of a causal link between the vaccine and rare cases of the blood clot. So with that in mind, although we take note that the European Medicines Agency and also the UK regulator, the MHRA, has said that the benefits outweigh the risks, including WHO last night as well, we would like to still deliberate at committee level in Malaysia because we also have supplies from other vaccines, from Pfizer, from Sinovac. The expert view, when the committee meets, may well be that we continue to use the AstraZeneca vaccine. Nonetheless, because safety is paramount and there is obviously some level of public consternation with the news, we would like to deliberate it and get the views of the experts and come out with our position after that.
Mm-hmm. YB, while you're on the line, you clearly mentioned that there will be quite a few other vaccines in the pipeline. For the benefit of listeners out there, perhaps you can outline what other candidates is in the pipeline and also what sort of roadmaps have you got in line for us for this recovery?
As you know, we have already approved the Pfizer vaccine, which has been the principal vaccine in the phase one rollout. And you have received the Pfizer vaccine yourself. It's highly efficacious, very safe, and it's been used in many, many parts of the world. We also have the Sinovac vaccine, which has also been approved and used, and I took that one. There are two different types of vaccines. The Pfizer one is based on an mRNA platform, and the Sinovac one is a more old-school platform, which is the inactivated virus is put inside your body to stimulate the immune response. We have AstraZeneca, as I said, but that is pending the committee's deliberation. And we also have under consideration by our regulators the Sputnik vaccine from Russia, which uses the adenovirus viral vector, as well as another vaccine, which is also pending review at the NPRA, which is the CanSino vaccine from China, which also uses the adenovirus viral vector, the AD5, and that is a single shot vaccine. We have also exercised our option under COVAX to acquire within our COVAX order vaccines from Johnson & Johnson, which is a single dose adenovirus viral vector, and also the Novavax vaccine, which is a protein recombinant vaccine. So these vaccines are all in the pipeline. I know there are some concerns about the pace of the immunization program. And at the moment, I want to make it clear that this is a function of vaccine supplies and delivery. We know that many, many advanced countries have bought up all the supplies of the vaccines that are manufactured by the Western pharmaceutical companies. We have as well, but their orders are in a magnitude that that is enormous compared to the orders that we've put in. So you see countries like even Japan, South Korea and Australia waiting for vaccination or vaccine doses to arrive, just like Malaysia. So we are at a point where vaccines will start arriving in greater quantities in June. That's why we have the three phases. And I think a lot of people, once the vaccination program started, wondering how come it's not my turn yet. But we made it very clear from the onset that there is a plan, that there are three phases. We're finishing phase one now with all the medical frontliners being vaccinated. And phase two will start next week in 2 weeks' time with the elderly as well as people with comorbidities.
And now we've seen some reports on Twitter that the kickoff of phase two will be staggered for different states. So not all of them will begin on the 19th of April. Can you confirm this, YB?
I can confirm that. There are several reasons for this. There are some states which have not finished their phase one. We included a few more frontliners that were missed out in the initial list. Community pharmacists, hospice care, people involved in private ambulance services. So the list from phase one grew in some of these states. So we have to finish off phase one, people who are involved in essential services or in healthcare. And once that's done, we can start phase two. But I can assure you that for most states, they will be beginning sometime in April.
Just very quickly to touch on AstraZeneca vaccine again, YB, do you know when JKJAV will make their decision?
We are scheduled to meet not next week, but the week after on Tuesday. That is our standing meeting date. We meet every fortnight.
Now, coming to the topic for today, what we want to discuss is these variants of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. And, you know, a lot of experts have already said this, addressing these variants will be the biggest challenge for all countries in 2021. There have already been at least five, what they call variants of concern, identified. Now, why are we worried about these variants of concern, YB?
We're worried for two reasons, because the variants have an impact on the transmissibility of the virus. That means it becomes more infectious, or it becomes more transmissible. For instance, the B1351 from South Africa is 50% more transmissible than the wild variant from Wuhan that was the original variant. The UK variant, the B117, is 70% more transmissible and 60% more deadly. So in terms of transmissibility, in terms of whether it's deadlier, it has a huge impact on the public health response once you've identified that those variants are present in your country. The other issue, apart from transmissibility, is the effectiveness of the vaccine against these variants. So we've found out that against the B1351, which is the South African variant, some vaccines are less effective or less efficacious against this variant. So this has a huge impact on the way governments will respond to these mutations or these new variants, because if a particular strain, the B1351, the South African strain, becomes the dominant strain in a particular country, then they will have to make significant shifts in their vaccine portfolio to ensure that they're giving vaccines which are as effective as possible against this variant. Otherwise, you're giving vaccines which don't really work. And we've seen this in South Africa, where they stopped using the AstraZeneca vaccine, not because of a side effect issue, not because of the blood clot issue, but rather because they felt that the AstraZeneca vaccine was less efficacious or less effective against the B1351 variant. And they discontinued the use of the AZ vaccine and shifted their portfolio almost exclusively to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which is seen to be more efficacious. So the issue of variants is not just in terms of how deadly or how transmissible the virus gets, but it also has everything to do with the success of your immunization plan.
Well, clearly, you highlighted that the impact of the mutation has on the test itself, the diagnosis, the treatment, and the vaccine efficacy. From your discussion with the international experts, do you have any idea how widespread it is? And how widespread is it, do you predict this to be in Malaysia?
Well, the answer is the picture gets clearer by the day. Because what we need to get is more information as far as genomic surveillance is concerned. And that really is doing as much genome sequencing and monitoring the results of the genome sequencing within countries. Then you are likely to find out what the incidence of a particular variant is in that country. For instance, we have already announced that in Malaysia, we have detected the South African variant here. That's really scary stuff. And we need to do more genomic surveillance to understand how prevalent that variant is here in Malaysia. And I'm happy to report that as part of our immunization plan, we have also secured some funding for genomic surveillance. We'll be channeling some funds to the Ministry of Health under the National Institutes of Health, as well as to the Malaysia Genomic Institute under MOSTI, to do more than where the mutations are happening in cases that are found here in Malaysia.
All right. So let's go for a quick break. And when we come back, let's talk a little bit about what this genomic surveillance actually looks like and who and to what extent are we currently doing it? And then we'll follow on with some questions that we've been getting from listeners, very much related to vaccines and variants. Don't forget, our lines are open. You can call us at 03-7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. We are speaking today, my co-host, Dr. George Lee, and I, we're speaking to YB Khairi Jamaluddin, Minister of Science, Technology and Information, as well as the Coordinating Minister for the National COVID-19 Immunization Program. We'll be right back, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-Ik, and my co-host, consultant urologist, Dr. George Lee. Our Doctor in the House segment today is featuring a minister in the house. We have YB Khairi Jamaluddin, Minister of Science, Technology and Innovation, as well as Coordinating Minister of the National COVID-19 Immunization Program, joining us to discuss COVID-19 variants in Malaysia. And more importantly, what does the presence or the prevalence of these variants in our community transmission, what does it mean for our vaccination program? So, YB, before the break, you brought up the fact that Malaysia has received funding for genomic surveillance. So when it comes to trying to get a better picture of what variants are present in Malaysia, how widely is it circulating among our community? It comes down to genomic surveillance. Now, what exactly does that look like?
So that's basically having to sequence the entire genome of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which is about 30,000 bases. So you need sophisticated machines like the Illumina machine, which we use largely here in Malaysia. And this is something that's been used all over the world. And essentially, you sequence the genetic code of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and you compare it to other examples or other samples from cases here in Malaysia to see if there's been a change in that genetic code. You see, when the virus replicates and they're copying the genetic material, sometimes a mistake occurs, and that's where mutations happen. If the mistakes are fatal, then the virus may die out. But there are cases in which the mistake or the variant is advantageous, and that allows the virus to evolve and survive in a different form. And usually the variant that we are concerned about is the variant of the spike protein, because most of the vaccines target the spike protein as the antigen to trigger an immune response and create antibodies. Now, when the spike protein mutates or changes, then there will be less antibodies which will recognize or be triggered by the spike protein or the changes in the hairstyle of the coronavirus, as I like to say it, and the vaccine becomes less effective.
All right. So, you know, when you talk about every time the virus replicates, that means when it is transmitted from one person to another. So, you know, the idea is that as long as COVID-19 is transmitting widely within the community, we are giving the virus a chance to continue replicating, and we're giving the variants a chance to continue developing. So, and that's where the kind of risk that you said has could arise. So, you know, we can't just talk about surveillance without talking about public health measures to suppress transmission, can we?
Of course, the response towards COVID-19 has to be a suite of measures. It cannot just be one thing. It cannot just be vaccinations. It cannot just be your non-pharmaceutical interventions like physical distancing and mask wearing. It has also got to include things like surveillance, as well as serology testing people to make sure that they still have antibodies after they've been infected, after they've been vaccinated, to see how long the vaccines last for. So it's actually a suite of measures that have to continue to take place until we can get this virus under control.
But paradoxically, YB, it does seem that some of the public health measures are being relaxed rather than being tightened. For instance, more social gatherings are allowed, things like that.
Well, this is a big debate for many, many governments around the world, the balance between lives and livelihoods. I think when you relax certain standard operating procedures, it's with the intention that people can move around more freely and enable economic activity to recover. So there will always be a balance, and countries struggle in trying to balance this. I think Malaysia is at a situation now where the third wave, although the number of cases went up a bit today to 1,800 plus, the third wave is on a downward trend, and we hope that the R0 continues to decrease. But again, we have to continue to be vigilant.
YB, clearly you mentioned that genomic surveillance is crucially important for us to contribute towards a bigger picture to look at the mutation. But that begs the question, of all the tests that we do in Malaysia, how many of them are actually false negative that we actually are harboring the mutation that we're not aware of?
Well, there are many, many educated guesses about the multiple, which is the actual situation. So we don't really know, but many, many countries acknowledge that the multiple could be anywhere between 8 to 10 times what is actually reported. So that's something that will manifest itself in the R0 number. That's why the non-pharmaceutical intervention measures are so crucial, because you don't really know what the true numbers are out there.
So coming back to genomic surveillance then, and the point that you made about Malaysia being able to ramp up more of it due to the funding that we're receiving, how much of it is actually and who is involved in carrying out genomic surveillance right now?
So the genomic surveillance right now are principally being done by the Ministry of Health, by MOSTI, the Malaysian Genomic Institute under my ministry, and also by our public universities. So these three entities are the major contributors towards genomic surveillance or genomic sequencing, gene sequencing in Malaysia right now. We have sequenced and analyzed 421 genomes of the SARS-CoV-2 virus so far. And what we do with this data is we send it to the Global Initiative on Sharing Influenza Data, or GSIAD, which is a platform that is managed at an international level. And also, we share this data with the WHO as well. Now, what as of 8th of April, there are about 1 million submissions of SARS-CoV-2 sequences on the GSAID. We plan to increase our contribution from 421 now to about 2,000 to 3,000 sequences that we want to send to GSIAD. And just as a matter of context, as of March, the United Kingdom has sequenced and sent 256,000 genome sequences of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. The more people share, the better. And this is how we develop the vaccines, because when the outbreak happened in Wuhan in China, they were quick to share the sequence of the Wuhan strain. And that was how people, how scientists were able to design the vaccines for COVID-19.
And it's been said to be an unprecedented level of, you know, open access and sharing. And that's what's led us to these all these vaccines that we have now. Ty on WhatsApp wants to know, with the variants that may come and go within our community, he's asking, does this mean that vaccination will be a continuous process? And I'm going to assume that he's asking whether some vaccines may be stopped, as, you know, you mentioned earlier with South Africa.
Yes, I have a duty to ensure that the vaccines that we administer are effective as well as safe. And by effective, it means that it must be able to do its job in generating a humoral and cellular response to the virus. That means it creates antibodies and it creates T cells that can fight the SARS-CoV-2 virus. If we have evidence to show that a particular vaccine is not producing the necessary necessary immune response to the SARS-CoV-2 virus, then we must abandon that vaccine, because we're just putting vaccines into people's arms that are not working as well as possible. At the moment, of course, take whatever vaccine is offered to you, 50% efficacy is better than none. But there will come a time when that efficacy rate may be challenged by these new variants. And at that point, there's no point using those vaccines anymore. That's why I insisted when we came up with the COVID-19 immunization plan, I insisted that the Ministry of Finance put aside enough money for genomic surveillance so that we can understand the enemy. If we are using guns that are not working against the enemy because the enemy suddenly has a bulletproof vest, then there's no point fighting that war anymore. You need another weapon.
And so does the allocation of sufficient funds include if the need for updated vaccines or booster shots comes into play?
At the moment, we have inbuilt in our contract with some of the vaccine manufacturers, for instance, Pfizer. I made sure that we negotiated into the contract a clause that says that if there are variants that are prevalent in our country and the vaccine is no longer effective and Pfizer has adjusted its mRNA technology vaccine to be more efficacious against a new variant, then we can immediately ask for the supply of that new type of vaccine and not use the old vaccine anymore. So that's built into our Pfizer contract, because we know the mRNA vaccine is easier to tweak. It's a technology where they only require about 6 months to tweak the formula of the vaccine so that it can be more effective against new variants. So we have that in place with Pfizer.
What about the Sinovac vaccine? Because I think that's the other huge supply.
Yeah, that one We are discussing with Sinovac right now and trying to understand what their strategies for variants are. With the Sinovac vaccine, it's a little bit more different because with the mRNA vaccine, what you essentially do is you introduce a genetic code into the body, which are instructions for your body to create the spike protein, which elicits the antibody response. So they can presumably change the mRNA code that goes in to create the spike protein of the new variant, which will elicit an antibody response. With the Sinovac vaccine, they put in the entire virus, a killed virus, basically. So they take the SARS-CoV-2 virus, they put it inside you. So I have it inside me now. And the body will look at that as an entire antigen and force a response. So perhaps in the Sinovac case, they will have to isolate the new variant, the new virus, which looks a little bit different, and develop it as a new vaccine. So we're in discussion with Sinovac on the issue of variants right now.
And, you know, this question, you must be getting it all the time, YB, but Mrs. Lee has messaged in to ask, can people choose which vaccine to get?
For now, we have to trust our regulators that the vaccines that we have chosen are safe and efficacious. So whatever vaccine you are offered at your PPV, your Pusat Pemberian Vaccine, once you receive your appointment, take it. But I can assure you, please be rest assured that if there is a vaccine that is not safe, that we get new data to show that its risks outweigh its benefits, we will pull that vaccine. If there is data to show that the vaccine has become totally ineffective against the new variants, we will pull that vaccine. So we will continue to monitor the efficacy and the safety of the vaccines that we offer to make sure that these two things are not compromised. But I only know of two places in the world where you can choose vaccines, and these are countries with relatively small population. That's Hong Kong and Serbia. Other countries, you go, you take whatever is offered to you.
YB, I agree with you. No, you know, any protection is better than no protection. And then on that basis, I agree with you. However, if somebody have had one type of vaccine, and then in the future, and then let's say more data coming out that they're further protection for another type of vaccine, do you have any data to say that somebody can take perhaps two or three vaccines in the future in their lifetime?
That data is still emerging, Doc, and we are monitoring that. What we know now is that the manufacturers and scientists around the world are trying to find out how long these vaccines are effective for. For Pfizer, released data recently to say that at 6 months, there's still the presence of significant neutralizing antibodies that has been triggered by the Pfizer vaccine. So once we get more data about the presence of neutralizing antibodies, how long for, then we can make a more informed decision on whether somebody who's been vaccinated with one vaccine can be vaccinated with another in the future. But I'm not a doctor, I'm not an immunologist either, but from what I know, I don't think it's unsafe. I think it's safe, perfectly safe, for you to receive a booster shot later with another vaccine.
We also have a question here asking, you know, with mutations of COVID-19 or the COVID virus continuing to come up, will there be a need for yearly vaccinations like with influenza?
This is a big question that scientists are debating, whether COVID ends up becoming endemic. Endemic in a sense that it just doesn't go away. It's there like the flu. But it's managed by both public health measures as well as health pharmaceutical interventions like a flu jab, like a flu vaccine, like a booster. So again, the science is still inconclusive on this. Many, many scientists are now erring on the side of saying that COVID will be endemic and that we will be required to vaccinate ourselves every year. And this target of a herd immunity may not be reached because the virus continues to mutate itself. Again, we don't know, and nobody has a clear answer to this right now.
All right. In coming to the presence of variants in our community, how prepared is Malaysia for, you know, the more aggressive, the more contagious variants? And, you know, looking ahead to a time when borders eventually reopen?
I think our health officials are extremely cautious and nervous about the opening of borders. We saw how, for instance, in Sarawak recently, there were cases of fully vaccinated Chinese nationals who came in, did the RT-PCR test, and they were found to be positive with a high transmissibility load on their in their bodies. So this has led us to rethink about how we reopen borders, which is not to say we don't want to reopen borders, but we really have to have a better understanding of where they are coming from. We have to, when we start thinking about reciprocal arrangements with other countries, creating travel bubbles, we have to understand the genomic profile of cases in that country. If that country has a prevalence of variants which are highly transmissible, lethal or more lethal, and variants which are very stubborn against the vaccines that we use here, then we must be more vigilant in the requirements of them coming in. For instance, insisting on the full quarantine, insisting on RT-PCR tests, those policies stay in place. But for instance, if they come in from countries where there is no prevalence of these variants based on our genomic surveillance of this country, then we can offer some relaxed measures for people coming in from those parts of the world.
Now, genomic surveillance is a challenge for some countries where resources are scarce. So does that mean that these kinds of travel bubbles, for instance, should not be opened up with countries where we know that they're perhaps a bit weak on genomic surveillance?
Well, logically, that would be the case, but that would be unfair to penalize certain countries like that. So we would try to, we would have to make some educated assumptions about a particular country when we do the analysis. But in terms of the initial first few countries that you want to open up with, I think you have to be on the side of safety and try to understand the prevalence of variants from that country first.
All right. We have a question here. It's a bit of a call out, I think, hoping that MOSTI will provide more research grants to public and private universities for focused research on developing different COVID-19 vaccine platforms. Is this something in the pipeline for MOSTI?
Yes. In fact, we have given close to 5 million ringgit already for preclinical research to University of Malaya, as well as to University Putra Malaysia for the development of local coronavirus vaccine. And I'm certainly on the lookout for more research proposals. In fact, we launched our research development grants 2 months ago, and I'm certainly looking for research proposals for pandemic management, as well as for research and development proposals for us to handle non-communicable diseases. So these are key areas in which we are really looking for top-notch proposals.
Well, there you go, Dr. Chong, who WhatsApped in. Do send in your proposals for the grant. You know, YB, I just want to share, we have a couple of messages here. One from Christopher saying thank you for all the good work that you've been doing, you know, to ensure vaccinations are rolling out. Another listener, MZ, who just wants to say kudos and well done for the good work. George, you have something to say?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, on that note, YB, you know that we all recognize the hard work you put in and all the obstacles and challenges you put in. If everything goes to plan for you, when do you see we will hit that magic number of 70%, vaccinated to achieve that herd immunity? What is your best case scenario that we will achieve that?
That's dependent on a few factors. One, the delivery of the vaccines and the approval of the vaccines. As I said, there are some vaccines that we have entered into certain contractual agreements which have not yet been approved by our regulators. We hope that they receive approvals soon so that we can commence with the deliveries of those vaccines. Second is on registration. We now have in excess of 8 million people registered. I think this is also because many Malaysians are still waiting and seeing if the vaccination process is safe and that there are no severe side effects or adverse events after immunization, I think the numbers will pick up. But based on our delivery schedule, based on the plans that we have, and a lot of people are saying, you know, the messages that you read out were kind messages, but there are also unkind messages, which I read on social media on a daily basis. And I read it to motivate and remind myself that we have to get this right for the country. And there are some people who say it'll be 2030 before I get my vaccine, the rate that we're going right now. And no matter how we explain the delivery schedule, there will be voices like this, but it's okay. I mean, I, as somebody who's in charge of this program, I need to understand what the public is thinking. I need to manage expectations. But coming back to your question, we will have we will start having more supply than the current number of registrations by about June or July this year. And that's really when the deliveries come in greater quantities, especially from Pfizer and Sinovac. And I briefed the National Security Council, Cabinet and PM recently saying that September is the critical point where we will make a determination whether or not we can get to the 70% by December. And September will be the critical point because that's when we really have a lot of supply. Beyond the number of people that are already registered. And if we cannot get people registered, those who haven't been registered, to register in September, then the rate is going to go down. And that the rate will go down in September, not because we don't have enough vaccines, but because we don't have enough people registered. So I told Cabinet that I'm going to come back in September and advise Cabinet whether or not we go for mandatory vaccinations in September. And that's going to be a big call. We're not there yet. But as I said, September is really when we would have enough vaccines to vaccinate the 8 million people already registered and have more. And if we don't get more people registered by then we have to make a tough call.
So we have a listener who's asking, why not roll out phase 2 and 3 together then, since the registration for, say, phase 2 is lower than what we need?
Yes, we're doing that. But the problem is we don't have enough vaccines right now. So we don't have enough vaccines right now this month to roll out phase 2 and phase 3. In June, we will start having a lot more. And that's when we can do phase 2 and phase 3 together. But I want to manage public expectations here. I've looked at the delivery schedule. I've looked at the bottlenecks that we're facing for whatever reason. It's not because we don't have the staff or we don't have people who to vaccinate. We have great KKM staff who can do this, but it's because we don't have the vaccine. We don't have enough vaccines right now, and that will continue from April till about May. Yeah.
All right. Now, just as a final message, YB, I know you have to go off soon. You know, a lot of people, we're talking about people who are demanding for faster rollout, but there are still a lot of people who are uncertain and they are adopting a wait and see approach. So what would be your message to encourage them to register now?
My message is that think of the vaccination process as your contribution to the people around you. By taking the vaccine, you're not just keeping yourself safe, but you're keeping other people safe as well. And I think that's really the message that we want to drive through our Lindung Diri, Lindung Semua campaign, because it's not just about you. You're not getting vaccinated because of just yourself. It's been shown, and real world data has shown, that the Pfizer vaccine, for example, not only prevents the worst outcomes of COVID-19, but also cuts transmission. So imagine what that does to you. It helps you in a sense that it prevents the worst outcome if you contract the virus, but it also prevents you from spreading the virus, asymptomatic transmission. And that's huge. And that's all about, not just about you, but also people around you, your loved ones, your families, people that you interact with.
All right. And George, do you have a final message for us today?
Well said. I mean, nothing else I can add, but, you know, obviously it is important to think about protecting yourself and protecting your loved ones. And also, like you said, you know, it has to be multifaceted. Even though you're vaccinated, I'm still cautiously making sure that I'm following all the SOP. And I think everyone out there should do so.
All right. Thank you so much for your time today. Together with my co-host, consultant urologist, Dr. George Lee, I've been speaking to YB Khairi Jamaluddin, Minister of Science, Technology and Innovation, as well as Coordinating Minister for the National COVID-19 Immunization Program. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.